This RN podcast has been handmade by Radio Artisans. Hello, I'm Richard Aidy. Don't forget the media report. Download it for your weekly media hit. You'll find it at the Radio National website.
A 2011 drone strike in the Pakistani region of North Waziristan reportedly killed up to 40 civilians.
A United Nations investigation has begun into the killing of civilians in drone attacks. The British lawyer leading the inquiry says he'll be looking at 25 strikes in Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, Afghanistan and the Palestinian territories.
This technology is here to stay. Its use in theatres of conflict is a reality that the world now has to contend with.
Drone strikes and targeted killings have become the weapon of choice for the Obama administration in their ongoing war against terrorists. But what impact is this technology having, not only on those who are the targets, both intended and unintended, but also on the soldiers who are controlling the drones, the people who make the decisions about who to target, and on the way we are likely to wage war in the future? Hello, this is Rear Vision on RN and via the web. I'm Annabelle Quince, and today we trace the development of drone technology and its impact on warfare and international law. So exactly what is a drone, and how does it differ from a missile or an ordinary plane? Ian Shaw is a research fellow at the School of Geographical and Earth Sciences at the University of Glasgow and specialises in the geopolitics of drone warfare.
An unmanned aerial vehicle, commonly known as a drone, is essentially a plane without a pilot, and one that is controlled remotely from a few meters away or from thousands of miles away, in the case of predator drones. And essentially, with the military drones at least, pilots look at digital screens and they control the planes with joysticks. In the case of predator drones in Afghanistan, the pilot is literally 8,000 miles away from the actual physical drone itself.
There's nothing special about a drone that didn't already exist in weapon systems hundreds of years ago. A piece of artillery is a weapon that, you know, is fired and the artillery falls very, very, very far away from where it's launched.
John Sifton is the Advocacy Director for Asia at Human Rights Watch.
What's different about drones is that they linger over battlefields and they allow their operators to look at what's going on and then make a decision about targeting much later. Drones are no different than piloted aircraft. What's different is merely the risk to pilots is eliminated. Some people say that it's more transformed than even that, that the fact that there is no pilot there actually leads to some form of alienation, some kind of psychological alienation from the act of killing. And that is where people start to get disturbed. But there's nothing really special about a drone as a weapon system in and of itself. It really just is another remote weapon system, no different than an arrow.
When were drones first used on the battlefield?
The first historical example in which there was really production of a drone-like weapon system was during World War I. The U.S. Navy hired various military technologists to work on an airplane that could fly on its own, and then at a preset altitude and distance go into a tailspin and crash. It was sort of a kamikaze without the kamikaze pilot. The system was never deployed. The war ended before it could be, but weapons development continued through the 20s and 30s. And in the 1940s, the Nazis perfected a system of the V1 system, which were basically the same thing, aircrafts that could fly by remote control and then crash. But these were all suicide, so to speak, suicide missions. I mean, the plane didn't come back. It wasn't until 50s, 60s, and 70s that the U.S. military started developing planes that could actually fly and return to base. And that most of those planes were used for surveillance. All of them, in fact, were used for surveillance.
In Vietnam, we had the Lightning Bug, which was really one of the first drones to be used in widespread surveillance. And it was used by the U.S. Air Force in the mid-1960s as part of Operation Rolling Thunder. And these drones, these Lightning Bugs, were used to fly pre-programmed flights and take still photographs, which were then relayed back to the U.S. homeland, actually, back to the Lyndon administration as part of a widespread surveillance strategy. But it was really with the rise of the Predator drone in particular that armed drones became far more normalised.
A US Predator drone is believed to have killed one of Al-Qaeda's top commanders in Afghanistan. Al-Qaeda's websites say that Mustafa Abu al-Yazid died along with his wife and several other members of his family.
The Predator drone's history is an interesting one. And really to understand the rise of the Predator drone is to really focus on one key architect of modern drone wars, and that's an Israeli engineer called Abraham Karam. Back in the late 1980s, his company, Leading Systems Incorporated, constructed two aircraft that were precursors to the Predator, the Amber and the GNAT 750. And these in many ways actually resemble the Predator drone if you were to look at it. And these were sold to the US military, and they were used in the Balkans conflict in the mid-90s. But again, these were fairly crude technologies. In particular, they couldn't be controlled from a great distance. They had to be controlled through a line-of-sight radio. So as a solution to that, the Predator was kind of an upgraded GNAT 750. And that first was rolled out in 1994 as part of the same conflict. Now, the CIA, this American Central Intelligence Agency, recognized quite early the importance of this technology for surveillance, and particularly surveillance in secrecy. And it kind of worked in partnership with General Atomics, which bought out Leading Systems Incorporated. And what you see through the late 1990s is the CIA in Afghanistan trying to hunt down Osama bin Laden. And they were really scrambling for technology that would let them survey from a distance without being spotted by the Taliban. So in the late 1990s and early 2000s, you really have the CIA driving the Predator drone technology.
In the intelligence gathering framework, it's right up their alley. The CIA has the geospatial work that they do with satellites, huge amount of analysts poring over satellite data. And so a drone is really no different than a satellite in the sense of an intelligence gathering device that can, you know, fly over the battlefield and collect intelligence and then feed that intelligence back to analysts. But before 9/11, the idea of putting weapons on drones had been considered and in fact was debated at the White House before September 11th whether to do that. But, you know, it never was resolved, and then the attacks happened, and then the decision was very quickly made to go ahead.
September the 11th, 2001 was really a watershed moment, and up until that, the debate was in the CIA to have a unarmed Predator drone flying over Afghanistan. But in the aftermath of September 11th, the Counterterrorism Center in the CIA was very much keen to arm the Predator with what's called Hellfire missiles so that the plane would have a surveillance and strike capacity. So I think it's really important, as you say, to see drone warfare as not necessarily as a huge break away from the war on terror, but really an outgrowth of the war on terror. And it follows the same kinds of logics that the Bush administration augured, which was an expanding battle space, hunting for Al-Qaeda beyond recognized battlefields such as Afghanistan to all kinds of shadowy borderlands where the US isn't technically at war with a country, such as, you know, places like Somalia. So drone warfare is very much part of the global war on terror that was started by the Bush administration in the aftermath of September 11th.
While the US has been reluctant to publicise their use of drone strikes, we do know that the first drone strike occurred in Afghanistan in 2002.
Well, not a lot is known about what happened back then in early 2002, but what we know is that at a very remote site in southeastern Afghanistan, which had already been hit quite a lot in the airstrikes in late 2001, and which had been secured by ground troops later in 2001, there had been some sighting of people up at that site. And for whatever reason, back at the Pentagon and the CIA, they determined that these individuals walking around on the ground were bin Laden and two of his followers. Before any of this intelligence could really be, you know, hashed out in any detail, a decision to deploy kinetic lethal force was made, and how it was made remains somewhat in dispute. And this was a brief period in U.S. history when it was acknowledged that the CIA used drones, that they were armed, and that they had missiles, and that they were used. And so much to the point where it was announced at a Pentagon press briefing, or discussed in a Pentagon press briefing, which is an amount of transparency that you would never see now and haven't seen for many years. But anyway, it was a brief period when they were willing to talk about these things, and they did. The CIA didn't talk about them, but the Pentagon did. As it turned out, of course, it was not bin Laden, and the three individuals turned out to be three very poor locals from southeast Afghanistan who were scrounging for scrap metal at the site of these earlier airstrikes.
Barack Obama took his time to decide on his Afghanistan policy, but the US president has now become more of an enthusiast for drone missile strikes than his predecessor. Washington's New America Foundation says that the US has increased the number of missile strikes from unmanned drones in the Afghanistan-Pakistan border region by about 50% since President Obama took office.
It's really the Obama administration that ramps up the strikes. During the whole Bush administration, there were around 45 drone strikes in places like Pakistan. When Obama becomes president in 2009, we really start to see this increase. In 2010 especially, we had over 100 strikes in Pakistan, the tribal areas alone. So really, it's been under the Obama administration that the drone wars have escalated to what they are today. Over 300 strikes under the Obama administration, which is far more than under the Bush administration.
This is Rear Vision on RN and via the web. I'm Annabelle Quince, and today we're tracing the history and development of drones and their use by the United States to target and kill suspected enemies. So who operates the drones, and how is the decision made about who to target and when?
There's an operator, and then there's a targeter, and then there are analysts who are poring over the video. And there might be multiple drones, there might even be other intelligence sources that are feeding into it. And in rare circumstances, there might even be human intelligence on the ground who has provided some kind of input. The decision to actually fire the missile can be made in different contexts. There are individuals who are known by name, who are wanted for connections to 9/11 or to Al-Qaeda operations in other countries, and they're known by name. They are targets. And when intelligence emerges that identifies where they are in time and space, the weapon systems are deployed to hit them in that time and space. But these other kinds of strikes that everybody complains about, there's another form, signature strikes, which are far different. And this is a situation where basically the Pentagon and the CIA have determined that there are circumstances in which the images and context on the ground can be interpreted in such a way that the United States can decide that what they're looking at, the people they're looking at on the ground, they don't know who they are, they don't know their names, they don't know what their precise circumstances are, but they've decided that the people they're looking at on the video screen are combatants who can be targeted by the United States and killed, that they are members of Al-Qaeda, that they are members of the Taliban, or they are members of affiliated groups who they feel they can target under the laws of war and under domestic U.S. law, and so they make a decision. But, of course, it's not that complicated. They're not wearing uniforms. It's not as though, you know, it's World War II and they're wearing the uniforms of the Wehrmacht. You know, it's not that simple. It's much more complicated. And the United States feels that they have a legitimate system to make that decision, that they can look at the context, who the people are, whether they're carrying weapons, where they've been, where they are, and determine that they are combatants who can be killed then and there.
A 2011 drone strike in the Pakistani region of North Waziristan reportedly killed up to 40 civilians. It's attacks like these under investigation by Ben Emmerson QC, the UN's Special Rapporteur on Human Rights and Counterterrorism.
It's impossible to know how many mistakes the United States has made, but more importantly, how many justifiable mistakes versus unjustifiable. I mean, what human rights groups would argue is that signature strikes in contexts outside of a traditional battlefield are a very problematic practice. In deciding who the enemy is, they make very big assumptions about who they're dealing with. Do they make mistakes? Almost certainly. It is impossible that they can argue that they haven't. There are numerous instances where the groups targeted on the ground do not match the facts of who the United States is engaged in armed conflict with. They've targeted village elders in Waziristan who admittedly have links with the Taliban, but who are not involved with Al-Qaeda at all, and who are not combatants. They have targeted individuals and claim to have killed them, only to find that they are still alive, and then targeted them again and successfully killed them, begging the question of who it was they killed the first time. It's really unambiguous, uncontroversial, that they have made mistakes. But the question is how many? If you look at the whole practice, you have to say there's a problem here. There's so many people dying, so many people being killed. It can't be that every single one of them is a combatant. And it can't be that they can so easily determine who's a combatant and who's not, especially in a country like Pakistan, where so many people carry weapons regularly and, you know, travel in and out of questionable places.
In the latest remote-controlled attack, a drone has killed Al-Qaeda's deputy leader, Abu Yahya Alibi.
The US doesn't officially talk about its CIA-run drone campaign, and the State Department's Mark Toner was making no comment on media reports of Al-Libi's death.
I was just wondering whether or not you can comment at all.
And I can.
Okay.
No comment, thanks.
Sarah Nucky is the director of the project on extrajudicial executions at New York University Law School and an advisor to the UN.
We don't have any of that information from the U.S. government. So what has happened in the absence of the government fulfilling its basic obligations to be transparent about its use of force is that a number of different organizations in the U.S. and the U.K. and Pakistan have themselves attempted to count. So from those, and these are based on media reports, so one has to be careful about relying on them, but upwards of 3,000 total individuals have been targeted, and of that, reports of between 400 and 800 civilian casualties.
The Pentagon's Captain John Kirby welcomed news of Al-Libi's demise.
This is a very dangerous individual, and for him to no longer be walking the earth would be a good thing for everybody.
It's the second time in less than a year the U.S. has managed to take out Al-Qaeda's second most senior leader.
International law traditionally has been in broad agreement about the meaning of self-defense, and a state certainly is permitted to use self-defense in response to an armed attack or in response to the threat of an armed attack. But the threat must be imminent. And it's that word imminent which restricts the context and the scope of when lethal force can be used. So what we see in the U.S. position as it's developed is that that concept of imminence has been expanded. And so now in the U.S. position, there's an elongated imminence. So one doesn't need to be responding to an immediate overwhelming threat, a direct threat, but that imminence would include striking someone who we know or believe is a member of an armed group and may pose some threat, even if ill-defined, at some point in the future. So around this issue, from the perspective of international law, there's quite a stretch of the concept as it's traditionally understood. And this is why so many international lawyers and UN officials have raised concerns since the white paper was leaked, because state sovereignty restricts how states can interact with each other and performs an important protective function for civilians. And so the concern is that if the U.S. is stretching imminence to mean really at some point in the future, even if there's no immediate threat, that other states may take this as an example, may take it as a precedent, and will also start attacking even when there's no direct immediate threat, but when they perceive there may be a threat in the future. And that this may lead to an increase in violence across national borders.
The drones have made Pakistan an increasingly perilous place for Al-Qaeda, and the pressure could encourage the terrorist group to seek new havens elsewhere. A growing number of experts now pointing to an influx of militants into Mali in West Africa.
Pakistan is a very difficult case because for many years the government there was denying that it was providing any consent. Explicitly, it was denying it. But then a number of WikiLeaks documents made quite clear that its private consent was completely at odds with the public statements it was making. But over the last 12 months, 24 months, the elected government of Pakistan has said repeatedly, and its parliament has passed resolutions saying that it does not consent. But of course, many commentators would say that there must be or that there is military consent to particular strikes or intelligence agency consent to particular strikes. So there's potentially an issue here where there's a difference in the source of the consent from the military versus the elected government of Pakistan. In Afghanistan, there the government as such has consented, of course, to the U.S. presence there. But around particular areas or particular strikes, the government of Afghanistan has raised concerns about whether particular strikes have complied. And as we know, in some areas, the president of Afghanistan has said that the U.S. is no longer permitted to use strikes in particular areas because of concerns about civilian casualties.
That's the question at the moment, whether or not the drone strikes, A, target the right people, and B, even if they do target the right people, whether or not those strikes have any kind of long-term military advantage. Now, the logic of targeted killing is that you kill a high-value target, perhaps a leader of a militant group, and that is seen as a military advantage. But the key question is whether or not essentially a decapitation strategy, a strategy that's built on kind of a logic of death as success, has any kind of feasible long-term gain. And if we look at where drone strikes now take place, you know, in 2012, 2013, there were far less drone strikes in Pakistan, and yet there were more drone strikes in places like Yemen, in Somalia. And you'll also see a recently opened U.S. drone base in Niger to survey militants in Mali. And part of that drive to an expanding battle space is the fact that Al-Qaeda, the core group in Pakistan, has simply relocated and expanded to certain affiliates in places like Somalia, in places like Yemen, in places like Mali. So really, the drone strikes in many ways have simply displaced the problem rather than in any way solved the problem.
Does the use of drones change the way the US military and the CIA make decisions about who to target and when?
The big question about drones is, do they change the psychology of the people who are making the decisions to deploy lethal force? And I think a lot of people at this point would have to answer yes. From the pilots themselves to the decision makers at the highest levels of the CIA and the White House, it seems increasingly clear that the fact that there is no risk to the pilot, that the weapon system can linger over the battlefield for long periods of time, which removes the split-second need for making a decision, which often in other contexts leads to people not making a decision to kill because they're not quite sure. And above all else, the sheer alienation from the effects of the violence, the fact that it's abstract and only appears via video and you don't smell it, you don't see it with your own eyes, it changes the decision-making process for both the pilot and the decision-makers at the senior levels.
Every strike is reviewed and assessed, and if there was a blame or a fault, then that process is in place to make sure that it's reviewed and checked.
Former RAF unmanned aircraft pilot David Cummins thinks the military's current framework is sufficient, and he dismisses the idea of computer game pilots, saying just because they're remote doesn't mean they're disassociated with the act of killing.
I did it for 7 years, and I can assure you everybody involved understands the severity of the actions that they take.
It's an interesting question because, I mean, on the one hand, drone warfare does resemble a video game, not only the look and feel of it, but the way that pilots control it with a set of joysticks and buttons that resemble modern war games such as Call of Duty and other types of games like that. And a common criticism, therefore, is that pilots are really quite alienated from the violence that they are part of. You know, however, recent reports have suggested that this isn't quite the case, in the sense of pilots witness in really quite intimate and graphic detail the effects of missile strikes. The cameras fitted to Predator and Reaper drones are really capable of seeing high-resolution imagery, so in the wake of a missile, pilots can often see limbs flying, blood spurting, and so on. And actually, there is evidence to suggest that the pilots suffer rates of post-traumatic stress disorder just as highly as other pilots, if not more. And there's also a sense in which these pilots are far more connected to the results of a strike than pilots sitting in a bomber, you know, thousands of miles in the sky during World War II, for example, in different kinds of ways, both are forms of alienation.
One of the biggest concerns human rights groups have right now is that the notion of a signature strike, the notion that you could make a decision about a target based on its appearance, say that, you know, this man has a Kalashnikov, he's walking on the side of the road, he's near a military base, he's a combatant, let's kill him. That decision, you know, is made by a human right now. But the notion that you could write an algorithm for that and then program it into a drone and then have the computer make that decision, which sounds science fiction, but is in fact what the Pentagon is already thinking about. There are already discussions about this, autonomous weapon systems. That is, to human rights groups, the most terrifying specter that is currently presented by the drones. The other concern, which is perhaps not as great, is the simple fact of arms proliferation. And that's the second thing. Drones becoming a regular weapon system that anybody and everybody can deploy.
There's an enormous amount of concern about the practices the U.S. is conducting right now and the policies that underlie those practices. But from a much longer-term perspective, and certainly from lawyers outside the U.S., there's real concerns about not just what's happening now, but what it might mean 10, 15, 20 years down the track for the very structure of international law, which was built up after World War II to increasingly protect citizens and protect civilians, and that there's a lot of concern that what we're seeing now is a stretching of categories, which is dismantling the protective function of international law.
It's such an interesting question. I think that we're still very much in the early days of drone warfare and drone technology. I mean, like I said before, it's very much a very crude technology at the moment. It's essentially a robot with a camera affixed to it that flies for, you know, up to 24 hours. But this is rapidly changing. Drones are actually, rather than getting bigger, they're actually getting smaller. And you see developments of drones that are the size of a fist that resemble insects, hummingbirds, and things like that. And really, there's a push to make drones what's called autonomous in a military sense, in that they are able to fly and cooperate on their own without direct human input. Now, where this is perhaps leading us geopolitically, what are the consequences on the kind of the world stage? Well, I would suggest the increasingly irrelevant notions of territory and sovereignty, and that drone warfare so far has shown remarkably little adherence to international norms when it comes to declaring war and to abiding by, you know, centuries-old rules regarding armed conflict. And we're seeing the battle space spread, and we're seeing notions like a theater of war and fronts become increasingly irrelevant as drones target individuals in very precise locations. I mean, I really think that the way that we imagine warfare has already changed, in that I think that Iraq and Afghanistan will be the last time we see large troop numbers mobilized. And I really think this logic of surveillance from the skies and strikes from the skies is really set to define conflict going forward.
Ian Shaw, specialist in the geopolitics of drone warfare. My other guests, Sarah Nucky from New York University Law School, and John Sifton from Human Rights Watch. Today's sound engineer is Phil McKellar. I'm Annabelle Quince, and this is Rear Vision on RN. Thanks for joining us.
If you wanna be somebody.
Now available to listen to or download, an intimate audio diary of a 16-year-old navigating the complicated path between two cultures, Samoan and Australian.
I look in the mirror and I'm like, oof, I'm 16 and this is what I look like, this is what my body is.
Join Yolanda on 360 Documentaries as she experiences the good times and the bad. That's I'm Full Samoan. Find it at the RN website.